I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. A majority of American men and women have put themselves on a diet at some time in their life, cutting and counting calories, eliminating carbohydrates, living off of shakes and prepackaged meals, using dieting apps, and most have had the same results. Whatever weight they lost, they gained back and sometimes put on even more pounds. And yet the diet industry is a multi-billion dollar business whose success depends on diets not working. So you try again and you get the same results. Even worse, they tend to create an unhealthy relationship with eating, which should be pleasurable, and they can make you feel bad about yourself. So today on Radio Times, if diets don't work, what's a better solution than restricting food? And how can we learn to make peace with our bodies? Joining us is Laura Yu. She's a registered dietitian. She's a certified intuitive eating counselor and owner of Laura Yu Nutrition. And Laura, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. And let's just get into it and talk about why diets don't work. And let's begin with our bodies. If we put ourselves on a, let's say, a strict diet, we really are restricting, let's say, calories. What does our body do in response to that, especially if this diet goes on for a longer period of time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so usually the first diet for most people feels very effortless, but shortly after they regain that weight and likely more back. And so with each diet, the body ends up adapting because we're wired for survival, and it gets smarter in terms of how it might metabolize the food. Your metabolism could slow down. It might store the calories in a very different way. And dieting mimics a famine. Your body has no clue if it's a real famine or a self-imposed famine. It has no idea that you might have access to food in your pantry or in your refrigerator. It just knows that it's not getting enough nutrition, so it's going to store it in a very different way.
So the body is sort of fighting back against the diet.
Right, exactly.
Well, let me get our second guest in on our conversation, and that's Charlotte Markey. She's a professor of psychology and health sciences at Rutgers University. And Charlotte Markey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And she joins us by Skype. I was just talking with Laura Yu about what our bodies do when we put ourselves on a diet. And she was describing that the body thinks, you know, that there's a famine or something, and in a sense sort of pushes back against the diet. How do you see it?
Well, I've been interested mostly in my career about the psychological effects of dieting and what it does to not just our bodies, but also our mind. And the consequences are pretty negative.
Meaning that, and I'm hoping that we can make sure that you're... We're going to... Sorry to do this to you, Charlotte. We're going to take you down. We don't have a good Skype line with you. We're going to probably toss you on the phone and get you back in on the conversation. So I apologize for that. So Laura, let me go back to you. And Charlotte was talking about just how our minds work, I guess, the psychology of being on a diet and why that doesn't work. Take us inside of our heads when we're on a diet. And I should say that probably most people don't want to be on a diet, right?
Right. I think what Charlotte was probably alluding to is just how much an emotional and mental toll it takes with every single diet. So, when we tell ourselves we can't have something or we quote unquote shouldn't have something, there is oftentimes an opposite effect of that, where we become even more preoccupied around that food that we are told not to have. And this preoccupation also increases preoccupation around body weight and body size. And so we see a lot of negative side effects of dieting that often aren't highlighted or don't come with a warning sign with the diet that is promoted out there.
Sort of like that idea is don't think about chocolate cake, and then of course that's all you're going to think about, right?
Yes, exactly. And so there's even this concept of habituation that generally happens in almost any human experience. And so like a non-diet version of habituation from a psychological perspective is that it might be two people who are in a relationship, and they have essentially grown to say those three words, I love you. And they, when the first time they hear it, they're very, very excited. And after some time, it's not that threshold of excitement is lower. So habituation has taken place. And when dieting happens, dieting impedes habituation from occurring because that person has not allowed themselves to be around the cookies, to be around the chips or the foods that they deem off limits.
Well, let me get Charlotte Markey back in on the conversation. And Charlotte, you're joining us by telephone, and thanks for your patience and to our listeners as well. So nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, hopefully my technology holds up for us.
I know, we are totally dependent on technology these days. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the psychology of dieting. And Laura, you was talking about just when we feel deprived, we want that thing that we cannot have. And no one really wants to go on a diet. It's something that you feel like, gosh, I really need to lose 5 or 10 or maybe even more pounds. So take us inside the psychology of dieting.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that it's understandable that we feel like a diet is the answer because we get so much messaging just from everywhere, and especially this time of year, that a diet will solve our problems. Not only will we lose weight, but we'll be happier, we'll be healthier, like life will begin again. So it's natural for us to want to pursue dieting as a strategy for weight loss and self-improvement, but the psychological toll of dieting is pretty severe, right? We end up really cranky, we end up feeling deprived, and we end up usually doing the exact opposite of what we set out to do, which is to binging on food, to overeating, because that deprivation leads us to be, well, first of all, hungry, and second of all, then to lose any sense of control or, as Laura was saying, habituation around food. We don't feel comfortable around food. We don't feel like we can take it or leave it. We feel like this forbidden fruit is super desirable and we want to have as much as we can.
Well, I'm picking up on that. I guess the idea if you go, quote unquote, off your diet, instead of one piece of chocolate cake, you have three, right, Charlotte?
Yeah, and psychologists call this the what the hell effect. And it's like, okay, well, I've had that one piece. What the hell? I'm off the diet. I'm going to have three. But if you were never on the diet, you might not have cared that much about having the cake to start with. And if you had it, it would probably be just one piece or maybe not even a whole piece. And you'd feel really satisfied by that. You'd enjoy it. End of story. But it's really hard for, I think, a lot of people, the majority perhaps even, to get in this healthy mindset and develop a healthy relationship with food where you can kind of take it or leave it.
Well, let me pick up on that. And actually, let me go back to you, Laura. You and I was thinking in preparation for the show, I'm thinking about, frankly, my own life. And we're surrounded by food. If you order a medium Coke somewhere, you can hardly lift it. It's so large that we're surrounded by so much food and food that is high in sugar and fat and salt, I mean, things that are truly not good for us. And it's, I think it's hard to resist all of that stuff when it's so omnipresent. Laura?
Right. I think that is generally the message or the consensus around it's within someone's quote unquote control or their willpower, when really it's the fact that all foods can be a part of taking care of your health, but it's the moral judgment that is imposed on all of these foods, this notion of what is a good food or a bad food that really seeps into someone's relationship with food and makes it really hard to break away from the cycle of dieting when there's so much morality tied to each morsel of food that you eat.
Well, I'm picking up on that, Charlotte. So we're surrounded by food and then we're told we're not supposed to eat it.
Exactly. It can really feel like a no-win. And we also get so many contradictory messages. We get a lot of messages about health and how important health is. And, Dr. Oz or whoever is telling us to be healthy. And then in the next breath, also telling us that we need to avoid certain foods. And then there's food everywhere. I mean, it's no wonder that this is really
confusing and difficult for people. None of us should feel bad, I think, for struggling with our relationship with food because the environment puts us in this position.
But Charlotte, so many people do feel bad.
Yeah, of course they do. It's hard not to. But I think, you know, the message here isn't necessarily that this is all depressing and a no-win. There are things that people can do to improve their relationship with food, and that will have, you know, good effects on not just what they eat, but really their entire life.
You know, I was thinking about, Laura, how children, young children, even babies, how they, I don't know if they think about food or, you know, their relationship or their interaction with food. And I wonder if there are things we could learn from, you know, our younger citizens about food and about eating.
Oh, I love that. I love that you brought that up, Marty. I do want to point out that we are all born as intuitive eaters. And what I mean by that is that we are all born with this instinct to know when to eat and how much to eat. And so babies are the great example of that. They generally cry when they're hungry, and then they stop when they're fed, and the cycle repeats itself. And then as this baby moves through like toddlerhood and then middle school, there becomes more external rules placed upon them: when to eat, what they should eat, how much they should eat, the time in which they should have their meal or their snacks. And then we layer on the fact that this child moves through high school and college and all of society's pressures to maintain a thin body, marketing and media, and it's very disconnecting. There's so much noise. Just as you were just mentioning, there's so much conflicting information around nutrition and how to take care of yourself that usually someone ends up relying on external factors to tell them when they should eat, how much. And intuitive eating is a way to kind of guide you back to being an intuitive eater, listening to your body's cues, and using your inner wisdom to make those decisions.
And Charlotte, we're almost having a break here, but thinking about sort of knowing when you're hungry, but also knowing when you're full, the psychology of that. How do we teach ourselves that?
It takes practice, because most of us, as Laura's saying, have really abandoned that focus on our basic physiology. Because we have so many cultural rules about food, and we have, you know, practical constraints. We eat when we have a break at work or break at school. We can't necessarily snack every single time we feel a hunger pang. So we are forced to, in many ways, ignore our basic physiology, and we become really disconnected from it. So it's important that we practice getting a little bit more connected, and this can take a fair amount of time, not just even weeks, but months or years. But it's really worth it for the end result of being able to both enjoy food and improve both our mental and physical health.
And that's Charlotte Markey. She's a professor of psychology and health sciences at Rutgers University. Also with us, Laura Yu. She's a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, owner of Laura Yu Nutrition. And we are talking about the fact that diets don't work, often create an unhealthy relationship with food and eating, and what to do about it. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
My husband didn't think I could lose the weight.
Boy, was I wrong.
The Slim Fast Pledge. Give us a week. We'll take off the weight.
Weight Watchers' new 1988 Quick Success Program is helping people lighten up. In fact, quicker than before. Thanks to an all-new program that makes losing weight healthier and 20% faster.
Dexatrim is amazing. I lost the weight I wanted without being hungry.
Dexatrim. You can't buy a stronger appetite control formula without a prescription. Just one capsule works all day to help you lose weight.
My life has been a constant struggle with my weight.
Food was basically where we got all our enjoyment.
We got fat. We decided to go to Jenny Craig.
And when we had the Jenny Craig meals, we didn't have to think about food anymore.
Because it was convenient, and it was well-proportioned, it was easy. It's really a whole new way of life for us.
And that's a montage of popular diet ads from the 1980s, 1990s. And the diet industry is a multi-billion-dollar industry touting something that mostly doesn't work, which is losing weight, keeping weight off by going on a diet. You can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We do want to talk about what works, but let me just read an email from Kurt. And I'll put this to you, Laura. He says, what factors do food additives such as high fructose corn syrup play in the obesity epidemic in the United States? I've read that it's almost as addictive as nicotine. Why do food manufacturers keep this compound in the food supply in so many items? Can you respond to Kurt's question, Laura?
Oh, yes, yes. So there is this misconception that sugar is an addictive substance, which just is actually untrue. There is no body of research that really supports that people can become addicted to sugar. People can have a very fraught relationship with sugar, but there's no such thing as becoming addicted to sugar. And sugar, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a carbohydrate. And there's not one type of carbohydrate that is going to be metabolized in your body that differently. Like a carb is a carb. A gram of carb is a gram of carb at the end of the day.
Well, let me pick up on that and go to you, Charlotte Markey. Thinking of, I mean, sugar, salt, fat, I mentioned that earlier. I mean, those things do, they do taste good, right? I mean, there's something about that taste in your mouth that really gets the taste buds going.
They do taste good, and they don't need to be forbidden. And I think what intuitive eating and breaking from diet culture allows us to do is to savor those foods and taste and enjoy them, but then also realize that we will feel better when we're eating more nutritious foods more often, so that we are in touch with not just our hunger and our fullness, but also just how we feel, right? And I know that if I eat a really heavy meal, I'll enjoy it and it might be great, but I also might feel kind of sluggish afterwards. So I don't want to do that all the time. I don't avoid it all the time either, right? But I think it's important to keep in mind how we're going to feel health-wise when we do consume foods that are less healthy for us.
But are you saying that we've sort of lost this connection between our body and how it feels when we're hungry, how it feels when we're full, Charlotte?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there's data to suggest that as young as about 3 or 4 years of age, kids are more focused externally and less focused internally when they go to eat. So they're thinking about the time of day. Is it snack time? Is it, you know, something I'm supposed to eat? Is it something my mom's telling me to eat? And they're not thinking about, you know, what's going on in my body anymore. And so culturally, we just get more in tune to external food rules from a pretty young age. And it's really easy to stay there and to not be able to focus anymore on what's going on for us physically.
Is that an argument to get rid of the 3-meal-a-day schedule that most people have?
I mean, it could be, and it could be for some people. But, of course, there's a practical reason why 3 meals a day have emerged, right? I mean, we can't just necessarily graze all day long, even if we'd like to, because we have other things we're doing in our lives. But I think, you know, some people really don't like a big breakfast. Some people love a big breakfast. And I think that responding to our own body's needs and doing what works for us is important. And so for some people, maybe it's not 3 meals a day. Maybe it's 2 or maybe it's 6.
Let me go back to you, Laura, because you're a certified intuitive eating counselor, and there's been a lot of press these days on what intuitive eating entails, the kind of philosophy behind it. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, so intuitive eating is a non-diet approach to health that helps you stop the cycle of chronic dieting and really tune into your body's signals and heal your relationship with food. It was created by 2 registered dietitians, Evelyn Triboli and Elise Resch, who really based their work on their patients. And it's a framework consisting of 10 principles that guide someone how to reconnect with their hunger and fullness cues, how to add in what we call gentle nutrition. So focusing on how you can maybe add in the fruits and vegetables rather than fixating on all the things that you can't have. Learning how to incorporate fun movement, which is oftentimes much more sustainable because your body doesn't really enjoy moving your body in a way that's stressful. Like, that usually is not the reason why someone wants to wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning when they're right. thinking about the pursuit of weight loss, right? Like, it's not right. really, it's not sustainable. So it's a whole process.
But is it also that there are no bad foods, and that you, I mean, on a, if you're a eating intuitively, are you eating everything, and can you eat everything?
Yes, that's correct. It's really about giving yourself unconditional permission to eat all types of foods and practicing putting them on a neutral playing field. So reworking your language around food, there's no such thing as good foods or bad foods, treating foods pretty much equally until you feel like these foods are not forbidden.
So I can imagine, though, certainly starting off on intuitive eating, someone, myself probably included, would say, hey, you know, I can eat everything. I'm just going to eat a lot of, you know, sugary foods for a week or two. Is that, that's okay?
So that is a very common and very common fear, very understandable, and that can happen. But what I would suggest is to kind of start with creating a list, a hierarchy of foods from maybe low anxiety inducing foods that you enjoy but are afraid to keep around in the home, to maybe medium and then high anxiety foods, and really beginning with the foods that give you low anxiety and keeping those things in the rotation so you can learn to be around them. Because if restriction was the answer, mm-hmm. this wouldn't be a problem. The dieting wouldn't be this over $72 billion industry.
But is it about losing weight, or is it about just having a being healthier and having a healthier relationship with food?
So I think it's really important to clarify that intuitive eating is not at all about the pursuit of weight loss. It doesn't guarantee or promise that your body's going to change as a result of going through this process. It's really about focusing on and developing a positive relationship with food that then affects oftentimes health outcomes.
How do you see, Charlotte Markey, how do you see intuitive eating?
Well, there's really only two options, it feels like, right? There's diet culture and dieting, or there's intuitive eating.
Right.
And many of us, whether we realize it or not, are caught up in a more diet culture mentality. And the antidote to that is to stop labeling foods and stop moralizing and focus more on what we actually want to eat and what's satisfying to us and when we want to. And so that's intuitive eating. And, you know, to go back to your question about what happens if I start this today and all I eat is, you know, donuts and hamburgers, I often tell people, well, what's the worst thing that would happen if you did that? Like, do you think that you would want to keep doing that forever? Because I don't know anyone where it actually works out that way, right? Maybe donuts and hamburgers are really appealing for a week, and great. And then they kind of lose their appeal because they're just like any other food. Once you've taken away this sort of forbidden quality, they really lose their power.
Let me read some comments here. An email from Kareem: when I was a nursing mom, I was told that if I nursed my baby on demand, i.e. when they asked to be fed, that they would become an intuitive, healthy eater. Is there any research on this? Charlotte, can I toss that back to you?
Yeah, so we do have some evidence to suggest that babies that are breastfed have essentially a more intuitive eating approach because they have more control over how much they're eating and when, because the mother doesn't really know how much they're eating often. But, you know, again, by the preschool age, a lot of times that's been sort of muddled by food rules in our culture. So it's not necessarily that breastfeeding means it's great for a variety of reasons, but it doesn't necessarily set a child on track for intuitive eating for life.
Here's an email from Dwight. I'll toss this to you, Laura. He says, I made a pledge to start eating healthier and exercise so that I could lose weight during the pandemic. Over the course of 9 months, I lost 60 pounds and have been able to keep that off for over a year now. I don't like to think of what I did as dieting, but I did pay closer attention to what I was eating when I was eating it and exercising regularly. And I wonder, just picking up on what Dwight was saying, Laura, but also sort of this word diet, maybe, I don't know if we need to redefine it or get rid of it, but do you think what Dwight was doing sort of speaks to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, so yes. The word dieting can be very confusing because there's like the traditional belief of diets, like something like Atkins or Weight Watchers or keto, that people really generally agree that that's a diet. But when I'm speaking about dieting or diet culture, I'm really referring to the belief system that values thinness as a marker of health and promotes weight loss as a means of moral status, which usually demonizes some foods while worshiping others. And so this hypervigilance around food or measuring health in terms of pounds loss generally does increase anxiety and depression and isn't sustainable. There's to date no research that supports weight loss as being or dieting being sustainable beyond 2 years. Wow. And so it's not to say that dieting can't work for anybody, but what evidence suggests right now is that for 95% of the population that does embark on a diet, it actually is not sustainable and usually leads to rebound weight gain.
And here's another email, one from Kate. Children are kind of forced into a situation in school in which they have to eat at certain times, whether they're hungry or not, or even at home, as the family has routine times for lunch and for dinner. How might schools' families allow for some flexibility so kids can eat when their bodies are hungry? Charlotte, you were mentioning sort of the impossibility of that, but is there a way to help people understand what it means? I think people know what it means to be hungry, but what it means to be full.
Yeah, and I think that there are things we can do to approximate intuitive eating, even within some of these constraints. So I have two kids who have very strange mealtime schedules based on their school schedules, but they're not always hungry at those mealtimes. And so, you know, I give them a snack essentially, or they eat when they come home, and I try to really work with them. It used to drive me crazy. They'd want to go to school without eating because it felt like I was being a terrible mother to send them out the door without a meal. But if they're not hungry, then I'm not going to force them to eat then. And then they can bring essentially breakfast for their snack time or whatever. So I think by just allowing for more flexibility and interpretation of these meal times, that can really help kids be more intuitive eaters. And, you know, sometimes people want to eat, you know, in the evening or something. That's another diet culture rule, right, is that you're not supposed to eat after 7 or 8 p.m. But if you do, then you may not be hungry in the morning. So there's a lot of flexibility, actually, in how we interpret some of our cultural food rules.
Charlotte, going back to you, and I'm just thinking, I mean, there's so many reasons why people can binge eat, and it could be anxiety, it could be depression, it could be, you know, family stress at home, that there are reasons even beyond dieting that can create a problem relationship with food that's just based on the kind of psychological stress that someone might be under. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, and a lot of people have been experiencing tremendous psychological distress these last few years. Yeah. And we've seen the Surgeon General's report recently commented on how that had affected young people in particular, but, you know, the rates of depression, anxiety, disordered eating have just been through the roof in the last year. It hasn't gotten better across the pandemic. These things have gotten worse. And oftentimes we look to food as a source of comfort and also as a source of feeling some control in a life that feels really chaotic right now. And I don't think anyone needs to feel guilty or bad if the relationship with food is deteriorated somewhat across the pandemic. That's sort of a natural response to what's almost a global trauma in some ways from a psychological perspective. But, you know, as a health psychologist, I do believe that behavior change is possible. And I'm hopeful that as people emerge from the pandemic eventually, that
we can start to change some of our habits. And maybe right now we feel we need some habits that aren't completely adaptive to get through. I don't know that that should be a source of guilt. We're all surviving the best we can. But we can change our habits gradually. And there are a lot of behavioral health strategies that can be helpful in helping us to develop a healthier relationship with food and exercise and just health in general.
Yeah, Laura, how do you see that? I've even heard people say kind of snidely about COVID-19 is about the 19 pounds that people have gained during the pandemic.
Yeah, I think it's very sad and very painful to add kind of more judgment and shame on over what has already been a very difficult past few years for a lot of people. And I think it's very understandable that a lot of people have developed a very tense relationship with food and kind of maybe learned how to cope with some of this trauma through food, because, you know, we saw that in 2020, it felt like a scarcity mentality around food. People were really preoccupied and stocking up and hoarding. And I think it kind of is important to explore like what's going on there rather than the judgment, which really isn't going to improve someone's health outcomes.
Well, and there's a lot of judgment, Laura, about people's weight, about their bodies.
Right, exactly. And I really think that adds to this pressure of weight loss for a lot of people and using the scale to define health outcomes, when really we should be looking at behaviors. And weight loss isn't a behavior. Behaviors are kind of thinking about movement, thinking about what type of foods, how do you feel, what your energy level, lab work.
That is Laura Yu. She's a registered dietitian who joins us along with Charlotte Markey, who's a professor of psychology and health sciences at Rutgers University. We are talking about the fact that diets don't work and why that is, and how to create a healthier relationship with food and with eating. And again, you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Atkins peanut butter cups are my favorite, but I always want one more. You? Yes, Hannah. The answer is yes. Chocolate, peanut butter, and zero sugar. We can have one more.
Noom Weight uses psychology to help you understand your habits, change them, and realize that when it comes to losing weight, it's psychological. Sign up now and lose weight for good at Noom.com.
And I feel amazing. So live the life you love. Lose the weight you want.
Join WW's Personal Points program today with a limited time offer at WW.com.
And Charlotte Markey, Weight Watchers is now www.com. Does that tell us anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's pretty clear people are catching on that diet is a bad word. And so we're going to shift the marketing to talk about health and wellness.
But does it have the same, in a sense, same pernicious message?
For the most part, yes. I think that it's still mostly just a diet, and it still can be problematic if it's not framed in terms of any sort of sustainable, manageable long-term goals.
So change diet to just living, right? Living and eating, right?
Just living. And I know sometimes people will say, well, a lifestyle change, that's just a diet too. And I somewhat disagree with that because, again, as a health psychologist and looking at many decades of research on health behavior change, it's not impossible. It's very hard to change habits. We are all creatures of habit, and especially so when it comes to food, it seems. But it's not impossible to improve our health. People certainly do quit smoking, take up exercise, even alter what they're eating across time. And so if people can develop bad habits, perhaps during the pandemic, and I'll put bad in quotes,
right,
because I think that some of this is survival, then I think also it's important to recognize that people can develop quote-unquote good habits.
Here's an email from Jeanette for you, Laura, who says, how do you get started on the process of intuitive eating? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, the first step would really be to check in with yourself and kind of look at your past relationship with food and dieting and how perhaps examine that relationship. Why has it not worked for you? How has it felt emotionally, mentally, physically for you while you've been dieting? A lot of times there's a lot of toll that takes on it, that sometimes you are just going through the motions of dieting without realizing the implications of it. And then the second part would be allowing yourself unconditional permission to eat. And you can begin that process by eating regularly. You spoke a little bit about, you know, is it important to eat 3 meals in a day? And I think that's a solid place to start, with snacks in between, just in terms of regulating blood sugar levels. And when you're undernourished, when your brain is starved, it's very, very hard to do the work. And it can be very difficult to feel at peace with food when you're constantly thinking about it.
Should we toss our scale and toss the BMI, the body mass index numbers? Should we toss those, Laura?
Yes, it's such
in the trash.
yes. It's such an ancient metric. I mean, this was developed by a Belgian astronomer, wasn't a medical professional. The studies are really looking across groups of white European men. So it is in no way representative of our current day to day. It doesn't take into account age, sex, body frame, body composition, fat distribution, or muscle mass that changes with age.
Well, let me pick up on that and go to you, Charlotte, which is, I think we associate health and some version of thinness. Is that incorrect?
I think there's really a paradigm shift underway in terms of our understanding of the relationship of health and thinness or weight. And the medical community's been telling us for, you know, at least 25 years now that thinness is incredibly important to health. And the data is really not supporting that particularly well at this juncture. And so I think, you know, we really need to be careful to not over-rely on weight as a metric of health, because there's data suggesting that people who fit into the medical category of overweight actually have greater longevity. So I think we really need to take a step back and not place so much importance on weight or body mass index. There are some illnesses that are linked with our nutritional habits and weight, diabetes being a prime example, but there are a lot of other factors that contribute to whether or not someone becomes diabetic, including just their family history and their fitness and exercise habits. So I think we have to be careful not to make so much of what someone weighs per se. People can be in great health at a higher weight, and they can be in really poor health at a lower weight.
So when, Charlotte, when you hear people talking about, and these are often, you know, public health people talking about an obesity epidemic in the United States, should we dismiss that? How should we think about that?
Yeah, this is hard because I think the medical community and public health, everyone's well-intentioned here in wanting to improve health. And I think that for a while, the data pointed us more or less in a direction of feeling like weight loss was going to be important to maintaining health. And I think as we look more carefully at some of those data and collect more data, it just isn't holding up as well. So I think, you know, the obesity epidemic per se has been overblown. Any efforts to address this quote unquote epidemic have failed. And so that tells you that how we're thinking about these issues is counterproductive at this point.
Laura, you're a dietitian. How do you see that?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, it's the there's actually the obesity paradox, and it's only considered a paradox because researchers with their weight bias expected the opposite to be true. And in fact, there was a large-scale study consisting of about over 40,000 people done about less than 5 to 6 years ago that found that nearly half of the people who are classified as quote unquote overweight, and then about a third of people classified as quote unquote obese are actually metabolically healthy, meaning they have normal labs around cholesterol and blood sugar and blood pressure, which indicate and point to good overall health. And so in terms of groups of people, we see the highest death risk actually among people who are in the underweight BMI category. And the lowest risk of death is people in the overweight BMI category.
That's fascinating and seems so counterintuitive to what we hear. Here's a comment from Susan. She says, I often wonder why more experts, when talking about health and exercise, almost never mention dance, something that you can do alone. And Laura, just, you know, we were talking about the pandemic, and I think a lot of people feeling as if in order to be safe, you got to hunker at home and you can't be going, you know, out to the gym, although you could take a walk for sure. But talk a bit, if you could, about just the importance of movement and activity and exercise.
Yeah, so there's new research that shows that it's more important to break up your day-to-day in terms of movement. It doesn't have to be necessarily 60 minutes of movement every day, but rather, are you getting up and moving your body throughout the day and finding joyful movement, which creates a more positive relationship with just overall exercise, and it's much more sustainable that way. So dance can definitely be one of those things to incorporate, even if it's not considered like a traditional form of movement, like going into the gym, which definitely has a lot of barriers as well.
It does, yeah. Doesn't often seem joyful. I wonder if you could speak to that as well, Charlotte, about just the importance of being active, but finding that thing that does give some degree of pleasure and joy.
Yeah, I mean, exercise is really the greatest, cheapest, probably public health intervention we could try to support. Exercise is good for everything. It's good for our mental health. It's good for our physical health. It's good for our immune function, which is something we've all been quite concerned about these last couple of years. And there are lots of great studies to suggest ways that we can get better at being active and actually enjoy it. So starting with just making smaller and more frequent commitments to movement. So similar to what Laura was saying, maybe that means walking the dog around the block in the morning, maybe doing something for 15 or 20 minutes at lunch, taking that dog on another little walk. It doesn't have to be a really intense, long, single workout. We also know that developing a commitment strategy for exercising can be important. And what I mean by a commitment strategy is, you know, telling someone else, I'm going to do this. So you kind of put it out there that you're committing, or getting someone else to do it with you, right? My husband and I have gone on a lot of walks across the pandemic, and it really helps if we say, okay, right before dinner, right after dinner, we're going to go walk the dog. And then if one of us gets tired, the other one will kind of be like, okay, are we going to do this? And sometimes committing in other ways. I know a lot of people don't want to be in a gym right now, but I was interviewing a woman just the other day for some of my research who said she really started exercising by committing to seeing a personal trainer for just a few sessions. That's what made her go to the gym. So there's lots of ways that we can make exercise more fun. We can also use a strategy called temptation bundling, which has to do with basically giving ourselves a treat for being engaged in exercise. So I try to save my favorite podcasts or books or whatever for while I'm exercising. That means that I can't listen to see what happens next until I'm out exercising. And that just makes it a much more enticing activity for me. Other people can come up with their own ways to encourage to themselves to be regularly active. But just with a little bit of planning and sort of strategizing, it can really make being regularly active a lot easier.
I mean, what I hear both of you saying is so reasonable and so practical. And I'm sure people listening think, Yeah, well, you know, that seems doable. And yet, if I can toss this to you, Laura, I think sometimes it just feels like there are these, I don't know if they're physical or psychological sort of impediments to getting going on this, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I think it's tricky to speak about this, because what works for one listener may not work for another listener in this sense. And it's hard to, I want to be careful not to generalize advice, but certainly if someone had, depending on their experience, if they have a trauma history, if they've been placed on a diet before as a child, or forced to engage in sports that they really did not enjoy, then it can make it very difficult, understandably so, to then incorporate movement. So it's this whole intuitive eating process is about, first of all, processing their history around movement, and then when they feel ready to slowly incorporate movement in and to allow themselves space to decide what do they like about it? What do they not like about it? Because when you're engaging in a movement that mimics that trauma, so and when I say that, I'm really speaking about if the instructor is using really harsh language and focusing on changing your body or your belly or your stomach or muscle building, and that's really triggering for you, it kind of it sets you back in some ways.
Let me ask you, this is sort of an odd segue, but to you, Charlotte, one thing I wanted to talk to both of you about was just what is behind cravings? Where does that come from? Does it come from dieting? What are cravings about? Just so we understand our food processing here.
I mean, cravings are partly due to experiencing restraint, in that when something is forbidden or we've decided it's bad or we can't have it, then we do tend to crave it. But there is also a certain physiological response to food, right? There's a mouthfeel and a taste, and we have a physical response to eating something. And some things like chocolate or ice cream, they taste really amazing. So we're going to have a greater tendency to crave some of those things with particular properties that just bring us that really sort of more excited physical response.
Laura, I know you said you didn't want to generalize, but is this issue different for men than for women?
I don't think so. I think the conversation doesn't really circulate around men that much. I think for many reasons, diet culture is just very pervasive, especially for women. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anyone is immune to or protected from diet culture.
Charlotte, do you see sex differences at all?
I mean, I've been doing a lot of research these past few years with adolescent girls and boys for books I've written about body image. And I think both boys and girls, and of course then men and women and people who experience any gender really, are exposed to diet culture. So they are experiencing some of this, but how it manifests can be quite different. So I see 75% approximately of young boys, adolescent boys, trying to change their bodies to build muscle. Huh. And that's not the way girls are responding to these diet culture messages. And so it's interesting to me. It's actually really fascinating how we're all swimming in this same sea of diet culture, but then the manifestation becomes a little bit different, especially at developmental periods where we're concerned about, really acting our gender and maybe attracting a significant other for the first time. And so we see boys and girls start to behave in kind of stereotypically masculine and feminine ways when it comes to interpreting diet culture.
We have to leave it there. Charlotte Markey, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Laura, you, thank you for joining us as well.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.
It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies' slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details. Save big.